Greetings, Ghost Family. Welcome to our second bonus episode, another installment in our monthly series of dispatches while we continue to work on the stories for our second season, which, as a reminder, is coming your way this fall, October 10th to be exact. So far, I can confirm that we've started digging into a cult, at least two mafiosos, and the legend involving a guy who dresses exclusively in coveralls and wingtip shoes. Of course, later in this episode, we're going to bring you another installment of our brand new segment.
Wild Card
Wednesday.
Wild Card Wednesday.
On this week's Wild Card Wednesday, you'll hear a clip from a live performance by Jill Chenault, who told the story we presented in episode 3 of our first season, A Spirit of Vengeance. But first, let's talk about what you're going to hear on the next several of these bonus episodes, because I'm really excited about it. For the next few weeks, we're going to present pieces from each of the Family Ghost producers about the work that inspires them to tell stories like the ones we feature here on the show. And the first producer I'd like you to meet...
Okay. This is not your story. This is someone else.
...is Jason De Leon.
I am very bad at taking notes. I take them, and I don't know where I put them.
This is the story of the moment I knew that Jason and I were going to work very well together. It was the end of a long Friday here at Family Ghosts HQ. And as we are wont to do on such Fridays, Jason and I had a joint session with our therapist, Dr. Basil Hayden. If you are not familiar with the good doctor, let's just say that his wise counsel is 80 proof. Upon completion of various podcast and baseball-related musings, I was heading out of the office when Jason said,
"Oh, Sam, by the way, if you have time this weekend, read the first 3 pages of John Steinbeck's Cannery Row."
"Just the first 3?" I asked.
"You'll see what I mean."
And with that, Jason put his headphones back on and settled in for a late-night edit. My walk home from HQ takes me right past the Greenlight bookstore, and I stopped in to see if they had a copy of Cannery Row. Pleased to discover that they did, I flipped it open and I started reading. The last paragraph on page 3 goes like this. "How can the poem and the stink and the grating noise, the quality of light, the tone, the habit, and the dream be set down alive? When you collect marine animals, there are certain flatworms so delicate that they are almost impossible to capture whole, for they break and tatter under the touch. You must let them ooze and crawl of their own will onto a knife blade, and then lift them gently into your bottle of seawater. And perhaps that might be the way to write this book, to open the page and to let the stories crawl in by themselves." I shut the book and immediately texted Jason 3 words, those words being, "Oh my God." To which he wrote back,
"Sam, we have to let the stories crawl onto the blade."
Jason coaxed so many of my favorite moments from our first season onto the blade, but I am most grateful to him by far for his stewardship of our season finale, None of Your Damn Business, which was a story that I told, and which was an incredibly volatile experience, both from a narrative and an emotional standpoint. I will never forget the moment early in the process when I told Jason about the various struggles I was encountering with the piece, after which he leaned back in his chair for a while and then looked at me and said,
"An electric dissatisfaction."
Somehow those 3 words became a guiding mantra over the months that followed. And as I later learned from Jason, they come from the singer-songwriter Josh Ritter, whose music Jason has loved for a long time. Here's a little taste from Josh's most recent album, Gathering. So for this month's bonus episode, you're going to hear Jason in conversation with Josh about the enduring allure of ghosts, the inexact science of songwriting, and just what the hell he meant by an electric dissatisfaction. Stay tuned.
I remember the night I became a Josh Ritter nut.
there's a venue called City Winery down in the West Village of Manhattan. It was the first night there of Josh's Works in Progress tour. And it turned out to be the last, at least until later that spring. Josh lost his voice that night after singing nearly 30 songs over the span of 2 hours. I'm the kind of person whose Instagrams come few and far between, but that night I felt the need to capture what was happening in that room. I had never seen a performance quite like it. Mama gotta look at you and got a little worried. Papa gotta look at you and got a little worried. The pastor gotta look, said y'all had better hurry. Send her off to a little Bible college in Missouri. Now you're coming back, saying you know a little bit about every little thing they ever hoped you'd ever figure out. The Red Sea, the Dead Sea, the Sermon on the Mount. You wanna see a miracle? Watch me get down tonight. Now, I have this like super dumb smile on my face, mm-hmm. but it's because like that was the moment I became like a Josh Ritter nut. I knew your music, but what it looked like to me is like all those songs were hitting you for the first time again.
Yeah.
And so like I just want to start by asking you off, like what does it actually feel like when you're on stage? Is that description kind of like apt that it feels like it's hitting you for the first time?
Yeah, it is. There's like I don't know that it's a skill, but it's something that I feel very lucky that I have, which is that once I get on stage, the rest of me goes to sleep, you know, and any worries throughout the day, any pressing concerns just seem to disappear. And for that reason, being on stage is just a, you know, it's the reward.
I want to dig a little bit more into that performance from that night, because the idea behind the Works in Progress tour, I was just completely thrown by it, because I can't imagine working out things in public, out what like a personal piece of art, quite frankly, like in public. And you certainly played songs that night that were polished, that you had been done, that you had been working on for years.
Yeah.
But you would also do this thing where you would sing a song, you would hit the guitar for a little while and just be like, insert chorus here, insert instrument here. Yeah. And so like, what is that process like for you creatively of working things out on stage?
Well, performing is really just, it's a metaphor for larger life. There are always things that don't go as planned. There are always things that you wish could have gone differently, or maybe you fell down on your face once or twice, but that you get embarrassed and then you move on. You know, we're all human, fallible creatures, and part of the joy of I think watching performing is the chance to take those things that are mistakes, you know, and leave them behind as gracefully and without as little stir as possible.
Right. And I guess that makes me think, Josh, your music inspired like a ton of this first season of Family Ghost.
Thank you.
And in the process of making that show, we would hit episodes or like come across ideas within episodes that we didn't quite know what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know if it was like, if we're going to put it into the story, take it out of the story. I always wanted to work for the audience, but there's always moments where I was just like, that's a detail that I don't want to get rid of.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how I'm going to convey it.
Yeah.
So thinking back at like the way you work through stuff on stage, how much of the audience is in your head the entire, is it always in your head the entire time that you're just like, I'm doing this purely for them?
Well, it's a selfish enterprise, because you know I find that I find the experience of playing a song for someone to be a lot like when you see a movie that you love. You see a movie that you love, you can't get enough of talking about it, everything about it, thinking about it all the time. You're telling all your friends. You finally get some people to go with you, and the first 5 minutes you realize, man, this movie sucks. You know, this is bad, and like, you feel kind of embarrassed. I feel that way when I find that I only really need like one person to play a song for before I realize what I feel about it. And you know, and it's like, and if the other person like really enjoys it, that's great. But it also shows me inside the song things that I want to smooth out or rough out, or maybe I decide this was a fun song to play once, but I'm gonna let it like feed the other songs. And it's different than with writing like a novel, where a novel you or any other thing where there's a delayed reaction you know, where you're working in your room and then only months later do people get to experience what you've been working on. You get that feeling right at the moment. And I found that when I was writing my book, I missed that moment of at the end of the day, at the end of the afternoon, playing that song for somebody because, you know, you're kind of
immediately gratified.
Yeah, it was great. I'm hooked. I'm hooked right. on the immediate gratification. Yeah.
So I want to go into a little bit of how you think about structure in your songs. So to start things off, how do you find that songs typically strike you first?
I think about it a lot of times, like, you know, I have this feeling in my mind of somebody making one of those really complicated little like secret boxes out of wood, you know, the types that are all dovetailed and really nice, and there's always a secret button.
Yes.
You know, and those things, the construction of the thing, the time you have to put into figuring it out, all these things are how a song works together. Some days in the morning I wake up and I've got a line in my head and it won't get out, you know. And there are times when you go fallow, you know, especially at the end of a record where you feel like, well, you know, this is probably it. I have nothing more to say. And then you just lie fallow for a little while. And then one day again, you wake up with the moxie and you want to write something new. And I wish there was a perfect way of doing it. But I also feel that each song does sort of demands its own way of being written. And then in the moment when I'm writing it, I don't remember how. You know, there's very few times I remember writing a song, but they always seem to come about at a time when all you have a whole bunch of parts kind of on the table in front of you, and you're just sort of, you know, bashing them together to see what fits.
I will say, on Family Ghosts, one of the things that we tried to do was let the story live in the skin that it was kind of born in, but we weren't really quite sure. It was like, I'm trying to come up with the right metaphor, but it felt like these stories, like you said, demanded their own way of being told.
Yeah.
And sometimes I felt like we were fighting against us trying to impose something onto it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm still thinking through the first season, because like making this show particularly was very difficult in that respect, because you want to feel like you have more control over the thing than you might actually, than you actually do. And do you, I guess you feel that way.
I do. I find that trying to force songs into a concept is difficult for me because it limits what I feel like I'm, where the songs are going. I find that my internal editor picks up really early on whether a song is going to go where I want it to go, and then can so easily discard it. Several years ago, I started writing with the idea of editing nothing from the songs. Like whatever song came out, you know, it was in July, I wrote a Christmas song just for the fun of it. It was in my head and I thought, I can't put this off until the colder weather. But I find that the side effect of that is that if you're writing regularly and you're doing, you know, working on a regular time frame, that you tend to have obsessions and things that you're thinking about all the time. In that period of time, you have these things that are just a part of your life or a part of what you're working on, and they take over, and they don't just kind of infect one song; they infect them all. So that all the songs have certain preoccupations, and those preoccupations can serve as a concept, but only, like you said, after the fact. Once you've settled and you start to see the outline of the whole project, then all the things that you were thinking about that whole time start to jump to the front.
Weird, you know? If this was the Cold War, we could keep each other warm. I said on the first occasion that I met Marie, we were crawling through the hatch that was the missile silo door, and I don't think that she really thought that much of me. I never had to learn to love her like I learned to love the bomb.
In Josh's song, The Temptation of Adam, he writes about two characters who are in an underground missile silo. The story is told from the perspective of Adam, who falls in love with Marie. It's a song I gravitated to all last summer as we were making the show, and I couldn't quite put my finger on why. But when I asked Josh about it, much like he just said, all the things that I was actually thinking about jumped to the front.
The way in with that song was the way it happens sometimes with certain types of songs, where the first line is, you know, just jumps into your head. If this was the Cold War, we could keep each other warm, just struck me as like not only like a cheesy one-liner, but also like a good way to enter a song, a good way to draw a character who is like not necessarily the most serious person, but, you know, is here in charge of this very, very serious job of like of being in charge of the nuclear missile silo, and that these people who are underneath the ground with each other for months at a time, you know, end up becoming, you know, just human beings to each other. They're not just uniforms. And I liked the idea that these two people would sort of fall in love in a slow and kind of like grudgingly slow way, but that it would become more and more of an intense relationship as the time for them to part got closer. When you start off with a blank page and you have one or two lines, then really the question is like, do you have the story all in your mind, or are you willing to take a character and follow them where it goes? With a song like Temptation of Adam or The Curse or some of these songs that are like long love story songs, I don't know where they're going to go at the beginning. And the characters, they, you know, I won't say that the characters jump in and surprise me and I'm writing them, but I'm surprised that where they end up going, these songs, you know, things aren't necessarily wrapped up with a bow at the end. They can be left at a cliffhanger. An important thing to do is to let the characters and let the song write itself, you know, and to go in the places where it you didn't think it was going to go, because really that's way more interesting and way more fun. So in that sense, I, you know, writing Temptation of Adam, which is about, you know, whether this person will push the button and end the world so that he can spend his life with this person underground, like is left as temptation, because I didn't know where it was going to go and I didn't want to give a pat answer.
Yeah. The last line is, and I'm tempted.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So at night while you are sleeping, I hold you closer just because as our time grows short, I get a little nervous. So I think about the big one, WWIII. Would we ever really care if the world had ended? And you could hold me here forever, like you're holding me tonight. I think about that great big button, and I'm tempted. Thank you.
You had mentioned these long love story songs. When I think about love stories, and also in particular, like the long love story songs that you write, I'm trying to remember where I read this, but like I read this somewhere where every love story is a ghost story, which is a story of something.
I looked it up during the conversation, and the line comes from D.T. Maxx's biography of David Foster Wallace, who apparently wrote the phrase frequently in his letters. Every love story is a ghost story. When I think about family ghosts, maybe we didn't set out to make stories that were love stories, but a lot of them ended up being that way.
The struggle I had in a lot of the writing of that story is something that you mentioned, where it's just like, there's not a clean bow at the end of a lot of these, because they are love stories.
Yeah.
Where it's not going to be tidy. You're not going to be able to package the thing. I think we're born with a lot of fairy tales that are just like, oh, you could, there's an end.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's an end. And I think specifically with the show, the hardest time we had was finding the beginning and finding the end. Mm-hmm. I think we always had the middle.
Right, 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 right.
I wonder if that's something you feel when you're writing songs. Like you have the heart of the thing, but you don't have the hands and the legs, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's like, I feel it comes down to like the idea of whether you're telling a morality tale or whether you're telling a story, like a fable. It tells you exactly how things are in life, you know. The tortoise and the hare, you know, and that is beautiful and it sets up perfectly and it becomes a truism in its own way, you know, but when we're writing stories and songs, I find that like the songs that I've always gravitated to, the songs that I love are not the ones that tell me how it is, you know, they tell me how things might be, you know, and how things could be. And, you know, like Blowing in the Wind is like, you know, a classic example of that. You know, here's a song that's only questions And the answer is off there somewhere, but never addressed. And I feel that that's one thing that we need with stories and songs is ambiguity, because we're ambiguous creatures. We don't necessarily pick up the morals when we should, and we certainly don't do a very good job, you know, carrying them forward in our own lives from time to time. I mean, we talk about them a lot, but it's very hard. You know, I think Bob Dylan said we do what is most convenient, and then we repent, and like and I think that that's a little bit more strikes to that. So the thing that I think about ghosts is that they are so much like a love song. They're so much or a song or a story. They are not a moral. They're more like a possibility. You know, of what could happen. You know, like thinking of A Christmas Carol or whatever, these ghosts that not only can like speak to the past, but also give a vision of the future. And so they float in this weird area between what we might do, you know, and what we do. Typically, you know, we're just like haunted by all our ghosts, you know, all the time, you know, the things we didn't do, the things we hope to do. And addressing those kinds of hopes and desires, but also regrets, are a big part of creating a song that I feel is real and doesn't wrap everything up in a bow.
We'll have more of Jason De Leon in conversation with Josh Ritter after the break. Welcome back to the show. Let's head back into the studio where producer Jason De Leon is talking to singer-songwriter Josh Ritter.
I have a question about nonfiction and fiction. The show that we make, Family Ghosts, nonfiction show, it is a long-form narrative storytelling kind of show.
Yeah.
We gather stories from these legends of families that people have told and passed down from generations, or sometimes they're even recent, more recent than that. And then we just kind of see what comes out the other side, I think.
Yeah.
But we have to adhere to a truth.
Yeah.
And so when I listen to your music, there's an art being made that sounds like it's coming a lot from personal experience.
Yeah.
I wonder where you start to lose that sense to adhere to the truth, to make a fiction that will elevate the actual truth.
Sure.
Of the matter.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'd say that I've never cared for autobiographical songwriting. There's people who are great at it and who love doing it. It's not my form, and it's not one that I naturally go to. But at the same time, I have to say that all writing is autobiographical. You know, writing is, I believe, just an excretion of the human body. You know, if there's ink involved, you know. But you start off with a simple thing like just to use a country idiom, you know, she doesn't love me anymore. You know, you can only tell that story about yourself so many times before
yes.
people are like, man, you are depressing the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And also, come on, get your life together. But there are other times when you have that, you know, she doesn't love me anymore, and you get the chance to imagine why she doesn't love him anymore and what happened between them and like who stepped in the way, or what was the catalyst for this, and those things to me are always so interesting to think about and to imagine, and far more fun to imagine than to open up my own book of troubles and read from one of those pages. You know, I find that like it's way more fun to have somebody living in Topeka than to have somebody like living in my house. You know, mm-hmm. And once you find out that they're living in Topeka, then all these other ideas start to open up, you know, like what's their kitchen like in the morning? Like what happened on Tuesday? Those things are so much more fun to write about. I try not to let facts get in the way, you know,
right.
There's the facts of what people will do in life. I remember reading this thing that Flannery O'Connor was passed on a story to that she had written to someone, a neighbor down the road. And the neighbor came back and said, this is just what people do, you know, or so this is the way some people are. And that's really what you're trying to go for is like, you know, the truth of what would happen in the situation that you're creating, not the truth that happens in the daily life, because, you know, we can't all have all the experiences that would end up shaping like such a wide range of what you write about?
That response prompted two questions in my head. The first one is, I think one thing that I personally struggle with in telling stories is the fact that it feels like she doesn't love me anymore. It feels like it's been done before. Like that kind of song has been done before. And in making this show, Family Ghosts, there's a lot of long form audio storytelling shows that exist with scoring, sound, scripts, and all that kind of stuff. And it kind of makes it a little bit difficult to trust that the thing will stand out on its own merits, kind of. And I wonder if that's a thing that you think about.
I remember, like, when I first heard, maybe it was Roller or Beethoven, like, the Beatles. It was amazing to hear this band covering this song, covering it closely to what the original was, but it was the Beatles. And it was like, so it became a Beatles song in its own way, you know? And I feel that you know, you can tell the same story over and over again, and we've proven it. You know, there's so few archetypes for our storytelling that, like, really you have to come to terms with the idea that you're going to tell the same story that everybody else is telling. But it's really how do you see it in a different way?
Yeah.
Like, I love this. My mom has this quote on her window in her office, which I remember reading as a young kid, that said, by Pascal, that said, see what everybody else has seen and think what no one else has thought. And, like, you know, we all see the things, but the challenge in writing something that is original is putting new flesh on those old bones, you know, and that's really the fun part, you know, because you know, everybody knows why she left the dude, but like, what does he know about it? You know, what's his take? You know.
One of the ways I've been able to grapple with that particular question for myself is that a few years ago, I started reading this poet, Frank Bidart. He's an amazing poet, but one of the lines in his poems is this quote, "We fill pre-existing forms, and when we fill them, we change them and are changed."
Yeah.
And when I read that, I think it lifted that burden of just being like, everything already exists.
Yeah.
But how can the thing that already exists change for you and make you change a little bit on the inside? And I wonder, when you're making a song, do you feel like at the end of that process that something has turned in you a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. There's this beautiful feeling of, and I think maybe one of the main reasons for writing and continuing to write is that feeling of kind of inner transformation. Because with a song or with poetry, I find these to be the most portable forms of wisdom that we have as humans, you know? Like, when I listen to Leonard Cohen say, "There's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in," that's like, you could spend a huge book reading that one truism, you know? And he has distilled it down to a single line, and you can carry that line with you wherever you go in your life, and it helps you.
And this is the reason why I wanted to talk to Josh. As you heard at the top of the show, there was a phrase of his that I found while working on the final episode of the first season, and it literally changed the trajectory of the piece. Electric dissatisfaction. When me and Sam were working closely on the story of his uncle, that phrase just kept popping out at us, because we were telling the story of his uncle, but there was something else happening the entire time in the background. An electric dissatisfaction. It's the line that we carried with us to guide the story, and so I asked Josh what that phrase means to him.
Dissatisfaction is something that I've come to terms with in the last several records, where it's not dissatisfaction with the record at all. It's a dissatisfaction with myself for not being able to, like, capture that kind of dark matter, which is always out there. And we hear it in our heads. We hear the perfect story, and it has all these things, but we can't tell it that way. With every story, there's the matter as you tell it, but then there's the dark matter that is out there in the world, all the other influences, all the other things, you know, the stuff that's left unsaid, the unspoken stuff, the stuff that has become family legend or become a part of our lives that has an influence on us, and we know it affects us, but we don't know exactly how, and we don't maybe have the words to be able to put that all into a story or something, because a story has to be portable. Once we start packing in all this other stuff, we, you know, it's harder, but we know it's there. We just don't sometimes know what it's for. And I feel that's what keeps us always telling the next story and trying, you know, trying to do it again, trying to get it perfect. Because you know, okay, I learned something from this song. This is what I learned. This song is great the way it is, but there's something about it that I missed. And I'm going to take that forward. I'm going to write the next song. And we always think we're going to get there. But the electric dissatisfaction is really what I feel like is what keeps us alive. You know, it keeps us moving forward, always trying to do the next thing a little better, always trying to describe that dark matter that's out there that we never really can quite get a handle on.
I just want to say that, like, your words and the spirit of your music guided this process so much, and so I sincerely thank you for taking
some time
to just, like, come out here and chat with me.
Thanks for giving me the chance. This was awesome. Thanks a lot.
Wild Card
Wednesday.
Wild Card Wednesday.
Wild Card Wednesday.
Wild Card Wednesday.
Wild Card Wednesday.
This is so weird.
Wild Card Wednesday.
This is so weird.
Wild Card Wednesday.
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 This is so weird.
Wild Card Wednesday. Wild Card Wednesday.
This is so weird.
Wild Card Wednesday.
So earlier in the show, you heard Jason talking to Josh about a moment of live performance and how that moment was the moment when Jason knew he was going to be a Josh Ritter fan for life. So for this week's installment of Wildcard Wednesday, I wanted to talk about a similar moment for me. As we told you in the intro to the episode we made with Jill Chenault, it was obvious from the first time I spoke to her on the phone that she was a one-of-a-kind storyteller. And as I mentioned in the credits of that episode, the opportunity to collaborate with Jill came from the fantastically named Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers, an organization in Detroit run by Satori Shakur. Before I even got on the phone with Jill, Satori suggested I check out one of her performances at the Secret Society. And for today's Wildcard Wednesday, I wanted to play you a little clip from the story that made me realize I needed to get on the phone with Jill right away.
She's a retired teacher, my mom. First and second grade, she used to make piñatas for her classrooms, and she would fill them up with candy and toys that she bought with her own money. She would keep food on hand in her classroom, or sometimes just bring it from home, for kids who she suspected weren't getting enough to eat at home. And when she had children that didn't behave in school, she would bring them home with her, bring them home for dinner. She made us play with them. And when she took them home after dinner, she would invite them to choose a toy to take home with them, our toys. But that's my mother. She's just a really, really nice person. When her friend Arlene had cancer, my mother fought that fight with her for 15 years, and she cooked food for Arlene's family regularly and just took it over there. When Arlene was too sick to get off the kitchen floor, my mother lay down on the floor with her. That's the kind of person she is. My mother can love or pray you out of a coma or cancer. And when kids teased me about having buck teeth, and I would cry, my mother held me on her lap and said, just ignore them. And every once in a while, she'd stop what she was doing and just look at me and say, you're a pretty little girl, as if she just noticed it. And we both knew she was lying. I could barely close my lips around all those teeth, but my mother wanted me to feel good and to feel pretty and just be patient until she could get me to an orthodontist. Now, there's a side to my mother that most people never see. My mother can cuss you out so bad that she will singe off your eyebrows and your eyelashes. She she would also discipline us with these mysterious kind of confusing commands and statements. I remember when I bounced a ball in the house, my mother said to me, if you don't stop that, you better. I didn't know what that meant. But I knew I should stop. When my sister and I would run around playing with the other kids after church while the adults were socializing, my mother would say, you better get someplace and sit down. And grown men started looking around for a seat. My mother was very, very nice, but she was stern. I remember the dreaded J.L. Hudson's incident. My sister had run off and my mother couldn't find her. And she was crying and running through the store searching, and a sales lady jumped in to help her. And then my sister jumped out from a circular rack of clothes and said, boo! And started laughing. And while the ooh from boo was still kind of hanging in the air, my mother snatched her up with one arm and wore her little behind out right there in J.L. Hudson's. She finally did put her down, but I have to tell you, my mother remains the queen of the one-arm snatch-up. She could snatch up a 55-pound child and beat that child within an inch of its life and never break a sweat. And she didn't care where you were. You could be in church. You could be in Hudson's. When my mother put her down, she wiped her eyes. My mother fixed her hair. And then she snatched her back up again. And she landed a few more before the sales lady finally said, ma'am, I think that's enough. On the way home, my mother was driving and growling at my sister Stephanie the whole way. Don't you ever run off and do nothing like that again, scaring me like that. I swear to God, I will be on you like we the people. You ever do some foolishness like that again, talking about boo. I give you some boo.
Family Ghosts is hosted and produced by me, Sam Dingman, with Odelia Rubin, Jennifer Lai, and Jacob Smith. Our story editor is Michaela Bly. Our managing producer is Mia Lobel, and Andy Bowers is Panoply's chief content officer. Special thanks to Season 1 producer Jason DeLeon for this week's episode. Make sure to check out his work on Slate's Trumpcast. Jason is not able to work with us on the second season of the show, and I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you, Five Sauce, for everything, tangible and otherwise, that you brought to this project. It could not and would not have happened without you. And of course, to the one and only Josh Ritter, whose music you can and should find wherever music is available to be found. Speaking of music, thanks to Evan Viola and Dave Van Ronk for the sick Wildcard Wednesday beats, as well as the vocal stylings of Shamaya Williams, Jacob Smith, Nicole Bunces, Lori Tobiasen, Lindsay Cradwell, Shelby Jordan, and Emily Mulholland. Join us again next month for another peek behind the Family Ghosts curtain, and thank you, as always, for listening. And I hope that all these ties will surely bind. When all in, will I be changed? When all in, will I be changed from this day?